The world is supported by Wise, the smart new way to move money internationally. Imagine a world where you could speak any language, travel to any place, and spend in any currency with ease. At Wise, they're building the money part. Wise is the world's most international account. It lets you hold and convert dozens of currencies all in one place. And you always get the real exchange rate with no markups like the banks sometimes give you. So whether you're sending money to Australia, hopping on a plane to Poland, or getting paid from France, Wise is all you need. Designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
At long last, COVID restrictions have lifted across England and Brits are inching toward normalcy.
Face masks no longer mandatory. Everyone in the shops today appear to be wearing them, so the public has made up their own mind.
Also today, climate scientists offer dire predictions, but could they actually be understating the danger? And a federal judge strikes a blow to an Obama-era immigration policy, leaving hundreds of thousands of immigrants with an uncertain future.
We are really tired emotionally, physically, from working so hard all the time just to survive.
Another challenge to DACA, and the space race of two billionaires is not impressing everyone.
What's up there?
What's up there?
Because you know space isn't going to be that great, but they're going to have to pretend like it was.
I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is good to be with you on what many in England are calling Freedom Day, the day that most COVID restrictions are being lifted. It's also ironic. The British Prime Minister and the Chancellor are both self-isolating after the country's health secretary tested positive for COVID-19. Across Europe, it's a different story. Countries like the Netherlands and Spain are reintroducing emergency restrictions as coronavirus infection rates soar. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry is on the line with us from London. How does it feel there today, Orla, after weeks of lockdown now coming to an end?
Actually, it feels pretty much like any day of the past few months, to be honest, Marco. For those of us who weren't at the nightclubs last night, it's pretty much the same. The difference on public transport, for example, was that face masks were no longer mandatory. But when I was on the train this morning, pretty much everyone was wearing a face mask. In shops too, face masks no longer mandatory. Everyone in the shops today appear to be wearing them. So the public has made up their own mind what they want to do. Where you did see the difference last night was at midnight last night. There was hundreds of people queuing outside nightclubs in London and across England. And a journalist with the I newspaper here recorded the moment that Heaven nightclub, which is a gay nightclub in Soho in London, opened at midnight. And you can see 1,000 people jumping into the air, and there's balloons and there's glitter, and it's pretty much like New Year's Eve. And the moment the video went up, of course, the video has since gone viral, there is just hundreds of comments underneath from people saying, you know, thank you, we'll be back into lockdown in a month's time.
Yeah, perhaps that cynicism is warranted because, meantime, Prime Minister Boris Johnson, Chancellor Rishi Sunak and the British Health Secretary, all three are self-isolating. Not exactly a good look to promote Freedom Day, is it?
No, it certainly isn't. Downing Street's argument is that on the balance of risk, the cases will rise, but because 68% of adults have been fully vaccinated here, they say the chances of people getting seriously ill or dying from the virus have been significantly lowered. And that's a gamble they're prepared to take.
You know, I think about essential workers, Orla, who have been on the job for the past 500 days. This is not exactly a liberating change of pace. What are people saying about the arrival of Freedom Day in the UK while infection rates there have jumped in recent weeks?
You're right. Cases now are at around 50,000 a day, and that's the highest rate since mid-January. The majority of the public doesn't seem to agree that this is the time to do this. There was a YouGov poll out this morning saying that while 31% of people were in favour of all restrictions being lifted, 55% were opposed to it, and many of them are scientists. I spoke to Dr. Geepti Gurdasani earlier. She's a clinical epidemiologist with Queen Mary University of London, and I asked her how she was feeling.
I mean, I feel quite scared because, you know, we've lifted those restrictions in the middle of what's a raging pandemic. We're seeing over 50,000 cases daily now and over 700 people being admitted to hospital every day. Our hospitals are telling us that they are really struggling with the number of cases coming into their emergency departments, and they're having to again, cancel routine care to cope.
And Orla, it's not just in the UK where cases are on the rise, is it? It's happening across the EU. And in some cases, restrictions are being reimposed, I see.
Exactly. In the Netherlands, for example, cases rose around 500% in the space of 1 week. And actually, the Netherlands is a good example for the UK because at the start of July, they opened their nightclubs. And a week later, their figures soared. Three quarters of the infections were said to be among young people. And Prime Minister Mark Rutte last week came out and said, look, we lifted restrictions too quickly. We regret it. We apologise. Nightclubs have now shut down again until mid-August. In Spain, cases have also jumped fivefold over the last 2 weeks. And at the weekend, curfews were reintroduced in over 30 towns in Spain, including in Barcelona. So, you know, while they're watching the UK going in one direction, the rest of the EU appears to be going in the opposite.
The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry on COVID restrictions going up and going down across Europe. Orla, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
From a blistering heat wave across Canada and the Pacific Northwest to massive flooding in Germany and Belgium, recent extreme weather has some climate scientists surprised by just how extreme it's gotten and how fast that happened. Scientists say climate change is making these types of events possible and are also asking, are climate models keeping up with the rapid pace of change? Joining me now is Michael Mann from Penn State University. Mann is a well-known climate scientist who has helped document the pace of change we've seen over the past several centuries. A broad question to start with, Michael. Do these extreme events we're seeing this summer lead you to believe that the impacts of climate change are going to be worse than current climate models predict?
Yeah, in fact, my co-authors and I have been arguing this for a number of years now, that many of these very persistent weather extremes that we've seen in the west coast of the U.S., in Europe, and around the entire northern hemisphere are tied to a phenomenon. It's got a fancy term, planetary wave resonance. What it means is the undulations of the jet stream get stuck in the same location. So you get these really big, high-pressure systems that stay put over the West Coast, for example, with the heat. And it's really the persistence as well as the extreme nature of these anomalies in weather that are associated with some of the most devastating extreme weather events we've seen. And that wave behavior in the atmosphere just isn't very well captured in current generation climate models.
So with planetary wave resonance, those waves of heat, they get stuck, as you said. Can they ever get unstuck? And how would you do that?
Yeah, they eventually do. Just like a particular weather pattern doesn't last forever. There's enough sort of natural variability and chaos in the system that it eventually breaks down. And that's what's going to happen here. In fact, there's evidence that it is starting to break down. But, you know, that's a little consolation to people who've been stuck under that heat dome for weeks on end.
So you know about planetary wave resonance, Michael, but did the recent heat wave or flood still surprise you?
It did. You know, it's one thing to be studying this stuff theoretically. It's something quite different to actually watch them playing out on your television screen. These devastating floods in Europe that are the worst on record in Europe. It's a reminder that, you know, by many standards, the climate models, the climate projections that you hear about are conservative.
I'm just looking at the pictures this weekend from Germany and the floods. I mean, how troubling is it that climate models were not able to predict this kind of weather? How damaging could those miscalculations be?
Well, you know, there is always risk. In the real world, there are things that are happening that are more extreme than what our climate models predict. And so we have to understand that there are limitations in the models today, and those limitations are actually a reminder that, if anything, we may be understating the impact that climate change is playing with these extreme events. And we have to be prepared for more extreme weather.
Are the models likely to improve with time and research, or is the flooding and warming world likely to stay like one step ahead of our ability to predict it?
I'm fairly optimistic that the models will get better when it comes to the impact that climate change is having on extreme weather events. Or another very important factor, the collapse of the ice sheets, the melting of ice and the rise in sea level. Climate models in the past have tended to underestimate that effect as well because of processes that weren't well represented in the models. And as scientists start to put those processes into the models, we get more realistic predictions. And unfortunately, they're pointing in the direction, once again, of things being worse than we predicted, you know, just a decade ago.
Michael Mann is a climate scientist at Penn State University. He's also the author of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Michael, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
It's D-Day minus one for Jeff Bezos, the multi-billionaire founder of Amazon. Bezos is preparing to lift off into space tomorrow with three other people. He'll be traveling in his own rocket, developed by Blue Origin, his private space company. Bezos is calling the launch historic, and it is, sort of. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Jeff Bezos was itching to be first, but wouldn't you know it, British billionaire Richard Branson beat him to it. Branson hurtled to space on his Virgin Galactic rocket ship 9 days ago. Comedian Stephen Colbert hosted the live web stream.
Greetings, planet Earth.
The musician Khalid performed on the tarmac. No word yet on whether Elon Musk plans to jump on his rocket ship, the SpaceX Falcon 9. But in any case, we have what the media is calling
the billionaire space race.
Billionaire space race.
The billionaire space race.
This space race is much different than the international race to the moon in the 1960s.
Until recently, only governments controlled the ability to send humans into space.
This is John Logsdon, the former director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University.
Now you have people like Bezos, Musk, Branson trying to develop that capability and build a business around it.
Elon Musk's SpaceX is more focused on winning large-scale government contracts, but Bezos and Branson are competing for a foothold in the emerging space tourism industry, charging hundreds of thousands of dollars for short rides to the edge of space. The billionaires have gotten a lot of criticism for what they're doing, and while it has not been kind, it has been funny.
Really, billionaires?
Here are comedians Seth Meyers and Amy Poehler.
You know space isn't going to be that great, but they're going to have to pretend like it was. Like when you go to Hawaii or a Michelin star restaurant that no one can get into. Dude, you haven't been to space? Oh, you got to go. They have an apricot salmon foam to die
oh,
for.
Oh, you got to go, bro.
Oh,
you got to get the
get
foam.
Get
the read the room. You know, launching these egotistical space races in the midst of a pandemic is just ridiculous.
Shannon Sterone is a freelance science journalist. She says the whole thing sounds like the plot of a B-movie.
Two billionaires are building competing rockets to try to race each other to space while half of the country is on fire. There's deadly climate change. There's a global pandemic where millions of people have died. If it weren't so upsetting, it would be hilarious.
It's my generation's job to build the road to space, so that the future generations can unleash their creativity.
Jeff Bezos paints his venture in humanistic terms, and so does Richard Branson.
We're here to make space more accessible to all, and we want to turn the next generation of dreamers into the astronauts of today and tomorrow.
The billionaires have their critics, but others believe in their vision. Sarah Masri is one of them. She's a planetary scientist at Ryerson University in Toronto. She says she always wanted to be an astronaut with NASA, but alas, it was not to be.
You have to be sort of, you know, cream of the crop, top of the line to be selected to be an astronaut with NASA. But now with Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, SpaceX, for example, they're going to be able to start taking people like you and I to space.
Yes, she says the first customers will be millionaires and billionaires, but eventually, she thinks, the ticket price will go down.
I kind of think of it as plane tickets and flights. When it just started, it probably was not accessible to a lot of people, but now flight tickets are becoming more and more affordable.
She hopes space flights will become affordable in her lifetime. And that's what space companies claim, says Guillermo Sonlein. He's an entrepreneur in Zurich with a focus on space.
But if you press them on how long is it going to take you to get the price down to $10,000, they don't even know.
Sonlein is psyched about today's space race for a different reason.
If you think back to Apollo 11, the average age in mission control was 26. And the ideas that these young people had about where they envisioned humanity being in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, I think we lost that somewhere along the way. And I think what SpaceX, Virgin Galactic, and Blue Origin and companies like them are doing that is probably their greatest contribution is they're bringing that back.
Sonlein says these companies are inspiring a whole new generation to reach for the stars. even if, for the time being, you have to be uber rich to get there. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. You may have heard of the spyware Pegasus before today. It had been used by Saudi authorities to monitor journalist Jamal Khashoggi before his assassination. Today we learn that the Israeli-made surveillance tool is pretty popular. A consortium of news organizations found that several countries are using Pegasus to spy on journalists, activists, and dissidents, including the Hungarian investigative news organization, Direct 36. Andreas Petia is one of the journalists there. He was also part of the investigation. Andreas, tell us a little bit about your organization, Direct 36, and how you discovered that people there were essentially being spied on.
Yeah, so Direct 36 is an investigative reporting nonprofit based in Budapest, Hungary. We have a team of seven people.
And how did you discover that you were being surveilled by Pegasus?
The project was led by a Paris-based organization, Forbidden Stories, and they had access to a database of phone numbers that were selected as surveillance targets by the clients of NSO. Then they found that one of my colleagues, Szabolcs Ponyi, who's an investigative reporter covering mainly national security issues, he was one of the targets. And we found that a second colleague of mine, András Szabó, was also one of the targets. And then the proof of their surveillance was that the Amnesty International's security lab, they analyzed the phones, the devices of my two colleagues, and they found clear traces of Pegasus software.
And does the investigation suggest that it was the Hungarian government that used this Pegasus tool? And how do we know that?
So the data itself doesn't say anything about the clients or who used the Pegasus software. But we know from Pegasus' own statements that they only sell their products to governments, to law enforcement agencies. And we also learned from sources inside NSO and also sources close to the Hungarian security agencies that Hungary has indeed purchased this software.
Mm. Andreas, how much information about you can Pegasus actually collect?
They can see everything that you have on your phone, your messages, your phone calls, contact lists, your photos, your videos, everything. You know, of course, they will know where you are.
Mm.
They can also turn the phone on. So it's a really, really powerful tool.
Specifically, are there things that you're concerned about with your colleagues that they might have been working on that may have been picked up by Pegasus?
Both of my colleagues were targeted and successfully, you know, their devices were hacked in 2019. Neither of them found, you know, any problems with sources. They didn't suffer any repercussions or there were no consequences.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more concerned about, you know, now this story, it's getting a lot of attention, which is great. I think the public has the right to know about this. But I'm also afraid that, you know, what kind of effect this will have on our work, on our sources or potential sources.
With this news out there, suspicions obviously turn to the Hungarian government as a client, as the client. I'm wondering if there's been any reaction from the government in Budapest to this news.
The initial response was, it was a very short and apparently very carefully composed answer. They said that they are not aware of any data collection mentioned in the request for comment. And then they sent a follow-up email a few minutes later, and that was a more political message. And basically, they asked the consortium if there was any foreign intelligence behind this reporting project.
Andreas, what have you and your colleagues done to protect yourselves since this news came out? A new phone?
Unfortunately, that won't help you too much. So, you know, Pegasus is probably the most well-known spyware tool, but there are many others. You know, changing your phone won't really protect you. We have to go back to our notebooks and in-person conversations.
Andreas Petio is a Hungarian journalist at Direct 36, talking about his colleagues there who appear to have been hacked by the NSO Pegasus surveillance tool. Andreas, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your interest.
In another front today in the cyber wars, the Biden administration and some U.S. allies publicly blamed China for a massive hack of Microsoft Exchange email servers. That happened in March, impacting tens of thousands of computers. Chris Painter has been following all of this. He was the top cyber diplomat under the Obama administration. Can you start off, Chris, by telling us a little bit more about the Microsoft Exchange hack? What exactly happened?
Yeah, this happened a little while ago, as you may recall, but this was an intrusion into a Microsoft Exchange service that many, many, many people use. So it was essentially a supply chain attack that then compromised many victims, corporate victims, other victims around the U.S. And the world. And what was particularly significant about it, I think, as contrasted to the SolarWinds intrusion that involved Russia, is it was done in a very reckless way that left these victim computers open to further exploitation by ransomware actors and bad guys. So it was a nation state that did it, but they did it in such a way that that left these victims exposed to further conduct.
Why is today's announcement of public blaming of China so significant?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. First of all, you know, just naming and shaming alone is not unlikely to change China's behavior or Russia's behavior. But it does have an effect. It has an effect in educating the public, educating and working with other allies and partners, and does have some effect on the adversary as well, or the wrongdoer as well. What I think is particularly significant this time is this was bundled with some other Chinese cyber activity, and the range of partners and allies that joined the U.S. in this condemnation was incredibly broad, broader than it's ever been before, including NATO, including a lot of European countries individually, which is significant in itself because it shows that this is not just a U.S. problem. This is a problem that we all need to focus on and take seriously. So I do think this is foundational for us to do anything else now. And I think, you know, we probably would have to take further actions to actually change China's calculus. But getting this out there and making it clear that the U.S. government has found this and has high confidence in this, and getting these other partners and allies to similarly come out, I think is very strong.
So what kind of message does it send to China? Does it signal a more assertive shift by the U.S.? Would China change its calculus?
Yeah, I think it absolutely shows a more assertive U.S., and it also shows the U.S. is not acting alone, you know, which is always difficult because lots of countries have financial and other dependencies on China. So it makes it very significant they came out with these countries came out with these statements. But it also signals that we take this seriously. This is unacceptable conduct and that we're going to take action. And so the first action is this kind of public attribution, public calling out. But that, as I said, is not sufficient. We're going to probably have to take other actions to convince China to not do this. So I do think there's a glide path here if we have sustained. This is not a light switch. You're not going to change it overnight. But you need sustained pressure and you need to be willing to use your tools like economic sanctions and other tools to reinforce these points that this is not something we believe is acceptable.
Mm. Well, interestingly, there were no sanctions put on China today. Sanctions were put on Russia for its past alleged role in cyber crimes. Why the difference?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that probably sanctions will be needed. But, you know, this could be the first step. You know, getting all these governments to agree had to take some time. I mean, my guess is the U.S. was ready to announce this probably a while ago, but felt it was important to gather these other countries to do it jointly with us. And I think that is important. But that doesn't mean that sanctions and other activities are not going to be forthcoming. I think this is step one. This is sort of the foundational step. But it certainly, I think those have to happen. I expect they will happen, but we'll see.
Chris Painter is an expert on cyber warfare and was the top cyber diplomat during the Obama administration. Thanks for joining us today, Chris. Appreciate your time.
Happy to be with you today.
You're listening to The World. After 20 years at Guantanamo Bay, a prisoner goes home to Morocco. The Biden White House picks up where Obama left off, aiming to shut down Gitmo. Just 39 detainees remain behind.
The only way to close Guantanamo is to move Guantanamo to the United States.
Which is a controversial debate. The future of Gitmo still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. For three decades, Sudan in East Africa was ruled by one man, Omar al-Bashir, until the 2019 popular uprising that ousted him. Now, 2 years after the end of Bashir's reign, Sudan is still a country in transition. And a big question lingers for the future of that nation. What role should religion play in politics? Today, we have the first in a series of stories about religion in Sudan, reported by The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi, who joins me now on the line. So give us some recent history here, Halima, and why issues around the separation of religion and state loom so large in Sudan right now.
Well, to answer that question, I have to take you back about 30 years ago to 1989, because that was the year when then military officer Omar al-Bashir led a successful military coup. And then him, together with the National Islamic Front Party and the Muslim Brotherhood, heralded this new period in Sudan that essentially Islamicized the country. It saw this big Islamic revolution to essentially bring religion and the state and society together. And that impacted all facets of life. And so when Bashir was ousted himself in a different coup after nationwide protests in 2019, as you mentioned, this put into question, looking forward for Sudan, how much of the past 30 years will be uprooted and what will remain the same? So this question impacts so many different areas of life in Sudan, and it's constantly coming up in different ways.
So what did all that mean for ordinary people in Sudan? Like, how did Islamic law come to play out in people's lives on a day-to-day basis?
Well, when this period of Islamization of the country started, it impacted all parts of life, from the economy to the education system to the banking system. All of those began to be impacted by this particular kind of religious ideology. So everyone was impacted in different ways. There were also these kind of public order laws that vaguely talked about morality and kind of what it means to be a good religious person, and were kind of seen as this excuse to crack down on Sudanese people. And so overall, the Islamization of the country had big ramifications for everyone, mostly because Sudan is a diverse country, especially religiously. You have Muslims from different groups. You have Christians, Jews, those who follow traditional African beliefs. So this put many Sudanese at odds with the government.
So Bashir was overthrown in 2019. As Sudan today looks at these questions about religion and nationalism, what is the current government there? What does it look like?
So after the 2019 revolution, military leaders came together with members of the political opposition and formed this transitional government tasked with steering the country towards these democratic elections in a couple years. And at the head of this government is a civilian, Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, who's leading the country. And together they all represent very different ideologies, different ambitions, different agendas for the government, who don't all agree about this question of religion and the state. So when I set out to report in Sudan, I really wanted to get a sense of what ordinary Sudanese people think on this issue. So on a very hot Friday afternoon, I went to a wrestling match, which is a popular pastime in Khartoum and a symbolic place that really taps into this question of religion and the state. Hundreds of fans turn out to watch athletes wrestle each other to the ground in an open field. This traditional style of wrestling comes from the Nuba Mountains in the southern part of the country, but the sport has become popular across Sudan. People crowd around the winners, cheering them on and throwing money at them. For years, people from the Nuba Mountains, many of them Christians, were in armed conflict with Sudan's government. But the ousting of Omar al-Bashir has brought a chance for peace. The new transitional government in Khartoum is negotiating with rebels from the Nuba Mountains, and they're reviving an old debate about secularism, the separation between religion and the state. I asked Mansour Dawood about this. He's a Nuban wrestler and says secularism is a good thing. Those people from the central government ruled us for 30 years in the name of religion, in the name of Islam, says Dawood, who's Muslim himself. But they've been lying to the Sudanese people, he says. Now we need secularism so we can get away from that nonsense. By nonsense, he's referring to the way Bashir's government waged war against people in the south in the name of Islam. For many Sudanese in the Nuba Mountains, the issue of secular government is personal, says Professor Juma Kundakomi. He's a Christian from the Nuba Mountains, and until recently, he was an official peace advisor for the prime minister.
Back home from the Nuba Mountain where I came from, the issue of the separation of religion and state, it's not something that is for leisure. No, this is something printed in their mind, and they all see that all the people they have been killed, bombarded, they were actually victimized under the name of Islam.
Earlier this year, the government in Khartoum signed a deal with the main rebel group Nuba, and it declared that Sudan had no state religion, at least in principle. That is a major shift from the mindset of the former government, says Professor Comey.
The state of mind of that the majority are Muslim in Sudan, and therefore the governance system should be based on Islam, is something which is dominating most of the political parties in the country. But the climax of this was under the NCP regime.
The NCP, or National Congress Party under Bashir, pushed a strict Islamic vision for Sudan, which is a diverse country both religiously and ethnically. That, Comey says, had major consequences 10 years ago when Christians in the South declared independence.
One of the main reasons that actually separated the country, the South Sudan, was the unwillingness of the previous regime to repeal Sharia law from the country. That would have actually saved the unity of the country.
Many people from Nuba say there's a risk of other parts of the country breaking away if Sudan is not able to take religious ideology out of government affairs. But even now, Comey says secularism remains a provocative and emotional concept for many Sudanese.
The meaning of secular has been corrupted in the Sudanese politics because it is equated to anti-religion movement.
At the Grand Mosque in downtown Khartoum, dozens of worshippers are finishing up their evening prayers. Sadiq Muhammad Ali is a businessman who prays here. Sudanese people are Muslim, says Ali, will die to protect Islam. If the former government made some mistakes, Ali tells me, the new one should correct them. But Sudan can never get rid of religion altogether. Sudan refuses secularism, Ali says, and this transitional government was not elected, which is true. The current government is supposed to pave the way for elections in a few years. People like Ali say that big questions like the separation of religion and state must be decided by an elected leader. Professor Hassan Al-Haj Ali Ahmed agrees. He's a political scientist at the University of Khartoum.
Any issue regarding the future direction of the country should be left to government mandated by the people.
Hassan argues the transitional government is heading down a slippery slope by trying to, quote, de-Islamicize the country. Islamic principles profoundly influence the way Sudan's economy, law, and government all work, Hassan says. So creating a secular system has major implications.
Are we going to see a complete overhaul of our educational system, our judicial system, our economic system?
Hassan warns that if the government makes too many changes on social issues, they risk a backlash from religious conservatives.
Because this is like you are trying to impose reform from above, like the government trying to make social engineering from top.
In other words, controversial issues about identity and religion, those should wait. But the current government has already started making big changes. It's recently introduced alternatives to Islamic banking, created a council to review family laws that are rooted in Sharia law, and it's making major reforms in its education system. We'll hear more about that tomorrow. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi, Khartoum, Sudan.
Sacred Nation is our ongoing series about religion and nationalism around the globe with funding from the Henry Luce Foundation. Explore the series online at theworld.org/sacrednation. 39 prisoners remain at the Guantanamo Bay detention camp after one man, Abdul Latif Nasser, was sent home today to Morocco. He was a commander and weapons trainer for the Taliban in Afghanistan, but was never charged with a crime during his nearly 20 years of incarceration at Guantanamo. Nasser is now in the hands of Moroccan authorities. He's the first prisoner that President Biden has transferred out of Gitmo, and each remaining case poses questions about the future of the camp. Ever since the military prison was built, Carol Rosenberg has reported on it deeply. She's with the New York Times. Carol, let's begin with today's news. What could this transfer mean for the remaining 39 detainees at Guantanamo?
So first of all, it shows that the Biden administration is back in the
business of trying to get people out and close the detention center, which is the unfinished business of the Obama administration.
Yeah, as to that question about the existence of the base, I mean, there's been a debate and questions asked with each administration since George W. Bush about whether or if the Gitmo prison would be shut down. What does this news tell you, and just your own understanding, having reported on the facility for so long?
That they seem to be adopting the Obama playbook, which is figure out how to get at the people they can. And then, I mean, they've made clear they're going to try to work with Congress on trying to figure out the solution for the people they can't or won't send to third countries. You know, Marco, the only way to close Guantanamo is to move Guantanamo to the United States, is to have a detention-style setting for the folks they will not release, the convicts or the people they want to put on trial and perhaps some people they think are too dangerous, and pick them up and move them to a U.S. setting, you know, came to call it Guantanamo North. But Congress has blocked that. They refuse to allow any of those men to be relocated to the United States for any reason, not for trial, not for detention, not for medical treatment. So it's a big, big climb for this administration to find the allies in Congress to allow them to move however many, dozens, a dozen, to some sort of secure setting in the United States.
Is this a partisan issue, and will politics again get in the way of moving Gitmo to the U.S.?
It seems to be kind of red meat in campaign season to accuse anyone who's willing to come up with an alternative to Guantanamo, to accuse them of being soft on terror. That's sort of the line, but there's no suggestion that these men will be released into the United States. The idea is that they would be tried, convicted, or plead guilty and put in maximum security cell settings.
So, Carol, you recently returned to Guantanamo Bay after the pandemic kept you away for 500 days. Was that the longest period of time you'd not been on assignment there since it opened in 2002? And what did you see? What was different?
I spent well over 1,000 nights at Guantanamo across the years, and I've never been away for a, you know, the equivalent of a full calendar year plus. And what was really struck me, Marco, is that virtually every single person who works at the prison and all of the leadership at the base has turned over. Came down with a group of reporters and a group of lawyers for the first hearing in a case involving a man accused of being an Al-Qaeda commander. And the only people who knew what the last hearing looked like a couple of years ago were the prisoner, the press, and the lawyers. All the soldiers, even the judge, were new to the case. There's a lot to be learned by the new people who are going to be handling these procedures.
New York Times reporter Carol Rosenberg has written about Guantanamo Bay since the detention camp was built in 2002. Carol, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Marco.
The future for a major Obama-era immigration policy is now in doubt. DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, protects certain undocumented immigrants from deportation, people who came to the U.S. as children. It also provides them with a work permit. But last week, a federal judge in Texas ruled that the program is unconstitutional. The World's Monica Campbell is here to tell us what this means for people in the program and what this means for the administration of Joe Biden meeting his immigration campaign promises. Monica, first of all, who does this ruling affect and not affect, at least for now?
This ruling affects anybody who wants to be a part of the program. And that's tens of thousands of people who have applied to be in the DACA program since the start of the year, more or less. And it does not affect, immediately at least, people who are currently in the program or are looking to renew their status within the program. So you can turn in your application, but immigration officials are blocked from moving forward on it.
Who exactly wants to end the DACA program, Monica?
People who are against offering any sort of path to citizenship, offering a larger reform to the millions of undocumented people in the United States, that they see this as kind of opening the door, not just to people here in the U.S., but perhaps to the world, that this will signal that more people can come into the United States and eventually get papers. This is seen as kind of a slippery slope test. DACA has long been that. The support for that remains strong and powerful, especially in places like Texas and a lot of other Republican-led states that support this court ruling.
So the administration is expected to appeal. But after that, what are the possible scenarios? I mean, could this go to the Supreme Court, as DACA has in the past?
It absolutely could. And I spoke to people who have been defending DACA at the Supreme Court, at the table. They are offering some blunt truth. They're saying that this judge in Texas, the district court judge in Texas's ruling, could very well pass all the way up to the Supreme Court, and that we know that the Supreme Court is a more conservative one right now. I spoke with Luis Cortez Romero. He is one of the immigration lawyers who's been right up in front defending DACA. He's in Seattle. He said that he is now really looking for a more permanent fix, hoping that Congress can step in and try and rescue the program.
We know that collectively we can move mountains and make things happen. And we've done it in the past. And we just need to make sure that we stick together so that we can do it now.
And what they're banking on right now is that Congress will step in, perhaps through the budget reconciliation process, and that you may see a pathway to citizenship and a more permanent fix for DACA and perhaps other undocumented immigrants rolled into that process. And we'll see. It's a very uncertain process ahead.
Right. As you said, that may happen. So what have you heard from people most affected by the latest news, people who want in the DACA program? Are they expressing concern about what this could suggest more widely about how Biden will deal with what many see as a broken immigration system?
There's a ton of concern. We spoke with one young woman in Virginia. She's 19 years old, Carla Mercado Dorado, and she applied for the DACA program about 6 months ago. She's originally from Bolivia, came to the United States when she was 2 years old. Now her future in the U.S. is uncertain. The floor is dropping out with a chance for papers, the chance to work, to be eligible for in-state tuition, loans, in a country that she's been in for most of her life.
Try to step into our shoes because we are really tired emotionally, physically from working so hard all the time and having to justify our existence, having to justify our livelihoods. It's hard. Yeah.
I also spoke with people hoping for DACA who have U.S. citizen children. Many of the people we're talking about are in their 20s and well into their 30s. Mm. They want change. So there will be a lot of organizing around this, especially considering it was part of Biden's campaign promise.
The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, thanks very much for this update.
You're welcome.
Lithuania, one of the Baltic states, has seen a sudden increase of migrants from Iraq. The Lithuanian government wants Baghdad to do something about this, but it's not as simple as Iraq changing its migration policies. The influx of Iraqi migrants has a lot to do with a dispute between Lithuania's next-door neighbor, Belarus, and the European Union. Belarus is accused of sending Iraqi migrants into Europe as a form of political payback. Reporter Rebecca Collard reports from northern Iraq about the people caught in the middle of a political spat in Europe.
In his barber shop in the ASEAN camp in northern Iraq, Sabasadun has a steady stream of customers. He trims beards and cuts hair for the displaced Yazidis that live here. But in the past 2 months, he's been hearing about something new from his clientele of mostly young men. They've been talking about Belarus, the Eastern European country now under EU sanctions over human rights abuses.
They said, like, in a very short time, like maybe 20 of my clients, customers, they have gone for Belarus.
Last month, Belarus used its fighter jets and a fake terror threat to force a passenger flight en route from Greece to Lithuania to land in Belarus. Authorities arrested a Belarusian opposition journalist who was on board. It was an audacious move that escalated political tensions between Belarus and the EU. Nobody here cares about that, but what they do care about is that Belarus now allows visa-free entry for Iraqis and 70 other nationalities, and that Belarus has a 400-mile-long, mostly unmonitored border with Lithuania, an EU member state. In the last month, more than 1,000 migrants and asylum seekers have crossed that border, compared with just 81 caught in all of 2020. Speaking to Turkey's state broadcaster last week, Lithuania's foreign minister Gabriela Landsbergis accused Belarus of helping the migrants.
They spent a few days in Minsk in government-owned hotels or in apartments, and then they are by buses, they are transported to the border, shown transit points, given instructions on what to say, how to act when you see authorities, border guards.
Most of those crossing were Iraqi, and many of them were from Iraq's Yazidi minority. 23-year-old Ibrahim Halil sits down in Sahtoun's barber chair and tells me the harrowing story of how he narrowly escaped death in 2014. That's when ISIS took over his village in Sinjar. The militants rounded up Yazidi residents and separated the men from the women and children. Halil says he was held in a mosque with about two dozen other men.
In the night, there was an airstrike into the mosque, so it became open and it was chaotic and they ran away. They managed to run away.
He says he never saw most of the women again. 7 years later, many Yazidis from Sinjar are still living in tents. They have few services and job prospects, and many say they will never feel safe in Iraq again.
We are living in a very bad life in the tents on this, in here.
So Halil met with a smuggler who promised he could get him to Germany through Belarus. Nobody here wants to stay long-term in Lithuania, he says. They all want to move on to wealthier EU states.
But we want to go to a country which is like Germany.
Outside the barbershop, kids from the camp play in the dusty rows between the tents. After being here so long, some of the families have set up small gardens, with vines growing up the side of the plastic sheets that are their walls. It's a bit of protection from the 100-plus degree heat. In the winter, temperatures can drop below freezing. Yasser Kader stands next to a line of freshly hung laundry.
I always tell my friends that I want to leave this country, and all of my friends are like me, because they don't see the life here in Iraq.
Across the country, Iraqis are facing a lack of jobs, water, and electricity. Security is a concern also, with rival militias competing for influence. Iraqis from all ethnic and religious groups are trying to get to Europe through Minsk. But Iraq's Yazidi minority feel particularly vulnerable. They say they were abandoned by Iraq's National Army and Kurdish Peshmerga forces when ISIS showed up in 2014. And even now, with ISIS defeated, they don't trust Iraq's security forces.
You know, we are a small minority, and we cannot live there, live here. And we are afraid of our future here. We always want to leave this country and to live in peace in abroad. It's impossible to feel safe here.
Hello? Hello, marhaba.
People here don't want to talk about the role of human smugglers. But I speak with one Kurdish Iraqi who says his brother left earlier this month. He had graduated from university and then spent 2 years unable to get a job. So he met with a trafficker.
Middleman, yeah, has the money. When the brother goes to the place, it says, like, I'm arrived.
Yeah.
So this brother here,
yeah,
he's going to the man. It says, okay, he's arrived. Now you can release the money to the smuggler.
He says the family pooled their money and went into debt to help his brother get out. It was a better investment than his brother's college degree, he says. Back in the barbershop, Halil says the smuggler he met wanted $15,000 to get him to Germany through Belarus. It would take him years to save that kind of money. Halil is also the only person I meet here who is really aware of the political dispute between Belarus and the EU.
So that's why now it's like it doesn't catch the people who are trying to go. So it's just like opening the border?
The EU has sent more border guards to Lithuania and is putting up razor wire along the frontier with Belarus to try to physically stop the flow of people. For Iraqis already in Lithuania, their fate is unclear. Lithuania's foreign minister is calling on Iraq's government to take them back and to cut commercial flights to Belarus.
We are not calling it a refugee crisis. We're calling it a hybrid attack.
But here in the camps of northern Iraq, plenty of people are as desperate as ever to find a route out of the country. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard, SCN Camp in northern Iraq.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being here. We'll see you again tomorrow.